good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
We have a visitor tonight. Welcome. Mm-hmm. We should introduce ourselves around.
Judy.
Wendy.
Yeah.
Jean.
Jeffrey.
Arnie.
Angie. How did you hear about us?
I googled Zen Buddhism in San Jose.
Oh, there you are. Right. The internet is wonderful. To some extent, yes. Well, we are finishing up, well, not quite, we've got a few more to go, the 10 prohibitory precepts, which in Zen are sort of essential information and guides for us, not like God pointing a finger at us and telling us to be good, but just a reminder that we do get angry, but we can pay attention to it when we do. We kill, we can't help it. We kill everything that we eat. Even bread is a grain of wheat. So if we're aware of that, it changes our whole relationship with life, our life, every life, and broadens the view in such a remarkable and wonderful way that it provides the space and the time in our life to feel the connection that it is to everything. There's a kind of freedom in it, even though it sounds like it's be good. It's not like that. So it's no killing, no stealing, no lying, all those things. And we've come to the one, we sort of jammed two of them together, and I wanted to say that if you all wanted to talk about those two again, we can do that, or we can go on to the no being stingy, which is a funny way of talking about generosity. So what we did was talk about speaking of others of past mistakes is the way we say it, and no praise or praising self and blaming others. So praise and blame and speaking are all kind of mixed up in the same boat in the way that we operate in the world. And it's mostly about how we express as we relate to everything. Yes.
The one you handed out to us says, no speaking of past mistakes. It doesn't put the others in.
No, but no praising self and blaming others does.
Right.
Yes. So no speaking of past mistakes is about others as well. All of these are about others, as well as the self. So if we speak of past mistakes, we can be saying, oh, Charlie, it's just did all these bad things. Or, you know, mea culpa, I've done all these terrible things. It's about both of those. It's about how we attack ourselves or others in some way. Without really even understanding, usually. It's an automatic reaction to something we don't like. And all that not liking in us creates the kind of irritation that keeps everything away in ways that are unfortunate. So, and it means we keep ourselves away from ourselves at the same time. we can do that, and we tend to do that in this culture. As I often point out, the Dalai Lama was astonished when he heard that we didn't like ourselves in the West. He said, what? You know, there were psychologists meeting with him, and they brought this up. They said, how should we approach this through Buddhism? And he said, I've never heard of such a thing. But that's the basic problem that people bring to a therapist. You know, what am I going to do with this rotten piece of something? You know, people don't. Coddle their children, I think, is what they do in Tibet. They actually coddle them when they're little and have no problem with whatever they do, instead of sweeping them up and saying, oh, you naughty thing, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that and you're bad. You don't tell a child that she's bad. So the child doesn't grow up thinking she's bad. It's just an idea. It's just one more cheap idea. It's just a thought. But it goes like that inside of us and defines us as we walk through the world. It defines us.
I'm interrupting, but I'm wondering how when you were raising kids, were you grounded in this philosophy at the time, or with this understanding?
My youngest child was 7, and then it was 10 and 12. So they were halfway grown by the time I started to sit. So, no, I didn't coddle. I sort of did. But I did tell them when they were misbehaving. I certainly did. I was not a good Tibetan, that's for sure. And I would get mad, you know, with the three little boys running around in my little house. It drove me crazy. So
I've heard it said in here once that, oh, this is an adult practice. Or somebody said that once.
Mm-hmm.
But I just feel like that can't be, you know, that it can't be just, it can't, you know, you must be able to convey this to a kid somehow that they can also touch that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They feel it. You can't convey it in words. And that's a place where words are useless, really. And basically, the basic understanding of all of this is that the essence of it is beyond words. But a child, anybody can feel it. So I think that is what we do, is we practice, and then we don't be self-conscious about it, but we try to do the best we can. And the precepts are there to say, oh, look at that, I got mad. You don't say, oh, bad me, I shouldn't have done that. It's just recognizing and then finding a way to navigate whatever situation you've created with that anger. Instead of being on your high horse and saying, I'm right and everybody's wrong, and gallop away from the mess you've made. So it's more like that.
Very practical.
Very practical. Extremely practical. Yeah. And very helpful. Yeah. It's inviting us to sit in the mess we make and acknowledge it and accept it and work with it, instead of turning away, oh, I'm so pure and good, I don't do things like that. But we do. We can't help it.
Yeah.
We just do. Well, the way we do the eighth precept, the way we say it, is no withholding materials or teachings. And that was always kind of mysterious to me for a long time. But it's just not being, as Bodhidharma says, not being stingy. Just being generous. And generosity is the first bodhisattva paramita. The first precept is just to open up your life and be willing to release into whatever you meet, whatever is needed, without holding back. And in our culture, that's difficult. We don't base our culture on that kind of way. We're always trying to get more, and we need more and want more, and we have more. We have so much. And I always love to read about the cultures where if you go to someone's house, you have to be careful not to admire things too much because they just give it to you. And they won't take it back. And the American Indians, I just met American Indians not long ago, and they were talking about the potlatch and how once a year everybody gets together and they bring all their stuff, all the things that they especially like, and they put it in a big pile and then just offer it to each other. Help yourself. Wonderful practice. And it breaks down the icon that keeps us in this tight little self that we call me, that is so protected. We have to keep what we have, and we don't want to let go of any of it. And yet, we don't own any of it. None of it. And any minute, we might be run over by a bus, and all the things that we think are so precious and so wonderful are just going to go to the dump in some kid's truck. You know, it's the way it works. So the worth that we put in, the value, the passion that we put into possession is a problem for us. Because it's always positing somebody special called me that is separate from everybody else and can't possibly just say, oh, you would you like this book? Here. And you can feel what it does to your mind when you do that. Something falls off. And that's why it's number one on the list of bodhisattva lists. Because without it, you can't really practice the precepts. And you can't really be patient. And you can't really use a lot of vigor or even sit meditation, much less be wise. So it's a really, really important precept. And all the various teachers said wise things about it. I have Koban's words about it too. Koban is my teacher. He said everything was given in the beginning to everyone from the start. Said if you're walking around and you're among the wildflowers, you let the wildflower be. You don't try to get it. You just let it be and enjoy it. When you open your hand, everything is in your hand. Already here. And also, nothing belongs to you, even yourself. So you have no self to limit. Every second we are unfolding teachings, and all materials are the dynamics of life. Nothing to call your own. So we ourselves are unfolding the teachings as we go, without anything extra, just being ordinary and every day, just like this, but being very present and attentive, paying attention. That's what the precepts are about. Just notice and be surprised, because you never know what's going to happen next. So I hope you all have something to say about this too. Jeffrey?
Well, I think you hit it on the head regarding generosity. So while I find all the precepts transformative and informing moment to moment, the generosity one, especially those of us who've been raised, or at least I'll just speak for myself here, in the culture that I've been raised in, I really have experienced that inquisitiveness that was, it seemed to have been trained. I was trained in inquiring, as my practice takes me more to the spirit as opposed to the acquiring,
yeah,
as it's moving, it points you in an entirely different direction. Well, we're this arc of where I'm moving to, and this letting go of things. Mm-hmm. And 6 years ago when we sold our larger house and got into a smaller house, this allowing things to go and giving them away, the party of all that stuff, was just wonderful practice for what we're talking about with the generosity. And now it's much more this on the front burner. It has that front burner quality. Mm. So a lot of times I'm always thinking about generosity in really minute, just moment-to-moment ways, whether it's when I'm at school and I'm working with a student, and I'm trying to be generous when I look at his or her artwork.
Yes.
And I would say 75% of what children produce, it's very, very, very easy just to say, oh, that's just absolutely remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
I find that it's not difficult at all to find the right words, three quarters of the time. It's for that other 25% that my practice and my training comes in.
Finding the words.
Yeah. It's just finding the words. How I can uplift somebody without destroying them.
Yes.
And so with language, how we can be generous just with our words, just with the right. So it's not just material things, but actually so much more has to do with our spirit and with what's coming from our heart.
Exactly. It doesn't have to be words or things. It can be a smile as you're passing by somebody. it can be a good thought for somebody. It could be this very small thing, but each one of those makes a huge difference in the whole dynamic of the world.
Yeah, I see how this stuff just pivots and is hinged by just the way you're viewing it.
Yes.
It's all about how you view it.
Well, there's your example right there. You go out and pick flowers before you come to floating Zendo.
I'm just so fortunate to have this space where I can grow them.
They're so beautiful. So beautiful. How does generosity work in the tech industry?
That's a good question. I think in our culture in general, it's interesting because in tech has a tendency of making society more unequal, right? Because it sort of concentrates wealth with people who are able to automate certain jobs, and the people who are not employed because of that have less. And so there's this divide that keeps on growing. And so the thing that happens as a result of that is that, what people who are like raising kids, for example, I think they see that happen, and it becomes sort of riskier not to like have all the best things for your kids, right? And so it almost reinforces that idea of needing to hold on to your wealth, you know.
Yes.
Whereas I feel like what you were describing, you know, this like Tibetan like upbringing, that's more possible if you all share equally. You know, it's not as risky not to hold on so much. So I feel like in this society, it kind of reinforces that.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I feel I can do and what we can do is, you know, be on the lookout. I mean, there's the practical side of things that we also need to look out for ourselves, but then to balance it in a way I think that feels just right for us, I guess.
Yes. Well, it happens in different ways. I know in my neighborhood there was a terrible murder, and people are collecting money now on the listserv of the neighborhood.
Right.
So that kind of thing is happening.
For sure.
People leaping to a need through this digital magic that we have. So it works in certain ways like that. We wouldn't have known even about it, even though it was just a few blocks away in other times. So I think that makes things possible.
Yeah, exactly. I think, and a lot of people, like people in tech, are also very much thinking about all those kind of things. But there's just this interesting paradox of Silicon Valley, where it seems like it's almost seems like there's no other place in the world as this area where people are so thinking along the lines of like having a good impact on the world. And yet this is, when you go to San Francisco, it's the place where the wealth inequality is just so humongous.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So it almost seems as if this positive impact that someone might have on the world is seen as a ticket for it to be okay to have so much more than someone else.
That's very painful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Both ways.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
For those who don't have anything and for those who do.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think this is actually in like this society in which we are, I think it's a very relevant reset. Very tricky.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
Seven minutes?
Oh, goodness. Well, I'll tell the Pema Chodron story of how she trains people in generosity. And she gave a workshop. Our Marie has told this story. She went all the way to Nova Scotia to sit on with Pema on the cliffs overlooking the Atlantic Ocean. And the first thing that they were asked before they came was to bring something really precious with them to put on the altar. And of course they all thought, oh, this is really great, something of myself will be on the altar. And she took something her grandmother gave her. I can't remember what it was. And then they had the week of teaching and sitting, and they were all waiting till the end of the week so they could get their stuff back. And they didn't get it back. She didn't give it back. Ouch. Oh, I see what's going on in here. Now I see. It's real. It's real. It is. Yeah.
I realize I shut down to, I go through periods where I'm just open to whoever, wherever they're at. And then I have to, I guess, kind of encounter the limit of what I can do.
And oh, that's the other side of it. That's a very familiar other side of it. When we start saying yes to everything.
Yeah, even yeah. If it's small. I mean, I just sometimes get involved with homeless, this guy Ken, and I just got really involved, and he was hanging around near where my apartments were, and you know, and it eventually it's just like I couldn't improve the situation, and in fact, somehow I got into this thing where, okay, maybe we should take you somewhere to sleep tonight, you know. And I didn't have an avenue for that, and the police came, and the police, you know, I don't know how that happened, but I didn't call the police. I just don't know how this happened. Maybe the people at that store did, but they came and just stood there, kind of. They seemed kind of condescending because it's like, oh God, we have to go through this with another well-meaning person where they have to realize it's better to leave people alone because are we going to, you know, I don't know. So,
yeah.
And my partner is like, well, we can't have Ken live with us, you know.
Well, I know somebody who did have somebody live with her.
Yeah.
It was a disaster. Yeah. Total disaster.
Yeah. Because their trajectory is not what you're thinking.
Yes, it's just not the same.
Yeah.
So, careful discrimination, discernment, really important. Yeah, but we don't know until we do it. You know, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Better to try it.
Yeah.
Why not?
I hope it was. Ultimately, kind of scary if he thinks.
Yeah, don't hurt, don't put yourself in danger.
Yeah, I wasn't in danger, but I just, I hope I didn't. Anyway. So.
I was wondering if you have any thoughts on sort of random acts of kindness versus working on like systemic change, right? Which is like building institutions, you know, as a way to spend your life versus the things that we do all the time every day.
It's always been my huge challenge to figure that out. I think it's one of our big questions. I was very instrumental in establishing a very tiny institution. And and immediately it was devoted to practice. It was to create a place where it would be safe and comfortable, where people could go and actually spend the night, and you didn't have to carry your cushions around, you would have them all there, and etc. And yet immediately all the insurance problems and the septic tank, all these things are built into having an institution, and you end up doing a tremendous amount of sort of infrastructure work that takes away from what you were trying to create. And after a while, if you're not careful, the people who are working to sustain it begin to focus on their own welfare and forget about the people, the reason that it's there, what people are to serve, who's to serve. So at Chikoji, occasionally some of the residents there who are supposed to be taking care of it and welcoming people to come become very resentful. You know, who are these people? You know, why are they coming and interrupting everything? We're having a good time here. And it's a real problem. And you know, in schools and hospitals and every kind of institution you can think of, it turns around and ends up serving itself rather than what it's set up to serve. How do you undo that? The Quakers, I think, are the most successful. They don't have any organization to speak of. Little bit, little tiny bit. But they don't have any big leader. They call their leaders weighty Quakes. The ones who have sort of natural weight in people's minds or something. It has a lot of problems, but it's another way of addressing that extremely difficult problem. I've never seen an answer to it, except to try to undo it over and over again. You know, maybe turn over the people who are working there so that they come with a fresh mind.
Just for example, I know that in Judaism and to some extent Islam, although I'm less familiar with those traditions, especially in Judaism, I think the religious institutions that I've seen in that, like for example, like Yonji University, there's actually a lot of emphasis and a lot of prestige in building, you know, on that sort of systemic change, you know. But there's also so many flip sides of that.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's tricky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's true, and they say Japanese Soto Zen has become very bureaucratic because it's been there for hundreds of years and lots of time to build up all these.
Right.
You know, you get so invested in what you're doing, and
yeah.
You lose your view, you lose that wider view.
Exactly. That's what I've noticed with, you know, some friends, like, were, you know, from college or before that, very, maybe the ones sometimes that are like most focused on doing something good for the world, but
yes.
at some point they're so focused on that that they sort of forget to treat the people around them respectfully. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, that can be a big problem.
Right.
Yeah, right. We too are the world.
Right? Actually, can I ask you this question? That's something that sometimes surprises me about Jobs and Steve Jobs, and I know he was a practitioner of Zen as well, and so he did something for the world that many people admire, and whether it's good or bad, you know, it happened and it's there, and it's definitely useful in some cases. But from like what I know from like the tales of Silicon Valley is that he wasn't actually very respectful to a lot of people that he worked with directly.
Well, I knew Steve Jobs when he first started to sit. When he was just a raggedy kid who was my kid's age. And so, and he befriended Coben, or Coben befriended him. And I'm not the one to ask about, really, because he got... We have a sort of family story around him. He sort of made a mess of our relationship. And then there are lots of stories about how mean he was. In his last years, as he was dying, he turned and softened. But he just started out as a kid and got swept up in it. And as far as I know, he was not caught up in the precepts so much as just keeping his institution going as best he could.
Right.
And he was greatly successful, very imaginative. But I know several people who were wounded by encounters with him.
Right.
Yeah. He never learned to grow up because he got caught up in success too soon. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, being in the whole, in all of this, in all of tech, it's interesting because you see that those are often the traits that get people ahead. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
But I just don't think that's what it's always about, right?
It's what happens.
Yeah, exactly. So that's interesting. It's practice.
It's practice, right. It's all practice.
Yep.
Well, we should stop. Next week, Jill will be here. And, I don't know what she's going to talk about, but she will be here.
There's supposed to be a super opportunity full moon tomorrow night.
Oh, that's right.
9 minutes before it's full, if we're sitting hard enough, it can become a light.
Oh. I wouldn't count on it, Karen. I don't think so.
I just was reading one interpretation of this.
It's already pretty full. It's already very full.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Okay.
I do.
It's more Tibetan, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Many Zen do service with many bows, many, many prostrations. With the precepts.
But for this particular moon in May,
that's the Tibetan.
Okay.
We don't do that in Zen.
All that noise from the Tibetan.
Yeah, yeah. Visak, it's called.
Yeah, that's right.
Visak.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll sit for 1 minute.